Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's find a foundation between the soul. Let's find a foundation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner here, as always, with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And even though it's past the time that Larry David said we're allowed to say this, we wanted to say Happy New Year, and we're sure 2025 is going to be just as fantastic as 2024, especially as...
Even more fantastic, I think, probably.
I love Los Angeles, California. But anyway, Derek... I just have a great feeling about this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should say, you know, our thoughts go out to folks who are affected by the fires. Or
absolutely.
Loved ones who are affected by the fires. And
absolutely.
It's just been shocking to watch, really.
It's been really terrible to watch. And I know a lot of people have been posting mutual aid links. If we get any good ones, we'll also post them in the show notes. And really, my thoughts and prayers, but beyond that, my genuine condolences, wishes of well go out to the people of Los Angeles. It's a wonderful city, one of the best cities in the country. And I love spending time there. And it's just a genuine tragedy that all of our inaction, selfishness, and greed has gotten us to the point where one of the great cities of the country, of the world, of the 20th and 21st centuries can burn down and no one seems able to do anything about it. It's a real tragedy. But let's talk about good news. Let's talk about international affairs. Let's get into some good news. And let's start with Syria. And Derek, tell us about the transition process now that Bashar al-Assad has fallen.
Yes. So there's been a lot of uncertainty about what exactly this transition process is going to look like. And there's still a lot of uncertainty about it. The nebulous new authorities in Syria were basically, for the most part, the government that has been ruling over Idlib province for the last several years, transplanted to Damascus and given remit over the entire country in theory. They're sort of, you know, talking about a transition process, very piecemeal. There doesn't seem to be any fully fleshed out plan in place yet, but they have given some clues of late. Ahmed Ashara, the former leader of, or I guess still leader of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, former al-Qaeda in Syria head, Ahmed Ashara, who's now going by his real name, gave an interview to Saudi Arabia media, Al-Arabiya, late last month, in which he suggested that a transition to elections, hypothetical elections, and who knows whether they would be competitive or something else, could take upwards of 4 years, that they're going to spend the first 2 or 3 years working on crafting a new constitution for Syria.
Election infrastructure in Syria at this time is ailing. It needs rebuilding. Drafting a new constitution or making amendments will take experts a long time, maybe 2 or 3 years, God knows.
This seems like a reasonable amount of time given where they're starting from and given the fact that there's big swaths of the country are still outside of Damascus's control and still facing potential conflict. We'll talk about the biggest one in a few minutes. But the first step, for example, according to the caretaker foreign minister, Assad Shibani, this week, is going to be formulating a national dialogue conference that would presumably kick off the process of rewriting the new constitution. It's going to be hard to do that when chunks of the country and several important constituencies are still wrapped up in sort of regional or local conflicts of their own. They're not going to be as able to participate in that process as you would probably like if your aim is to ensure the broadest possible participation. Now, I will say there have been some concerns raised of late, legitimate ones, I think, because of decisions that this caretaker government has made. There have been a number of raids that is carried out looking for, allegedly at least, former officials in the now ousted Assad regime. A lot of those raids have targeted Alawite neighborhoods. Now, there is a connection between the Alawite community and the Assad regime. Assad himself was Alawite. A lot of the upper officials in his government were Alawite. And yet these raids also take on the character of reprisal attacks against the Alawite community, or at least raise fears about reprisal attacks, which we've also seen happen on not in an official capacity, but in a more kind of haphazard anecdotal way. We've also seen those kinds of attacks. So there are concerns about that. The U.S. government has even gone so far as to express concerns to the interim authorities about these sorts of incidents. There's another swath of changes. Another issue is a swath of changes that the interim government has made to Syria's educational curriculum, which play around with especially issues related to the Islamic studies courses that children are taking. Definition, they've done things like defining a Quranic phrase referring to people who strayed from the path as Christians and Jews, which is a new thing that was not present in the textbooks when Assad was in power. They have removed references to historical figures, not, I think, from the history text, but from the Islamic studies curriculum. And so there's a lot of concern, I think, that this could indicate a direction that this government wants to go or will go, which is the sort of extremist Salafist jihadist, which are its roots. Hayat al-Nisham has its roots in al-Qaeda and this ideology. And so the concern is that they are eventually going to wind up there. I don't think anything in the changes that they've made necessarily raises any immediate red flags. But even the fact that they've prioritized making these changes to the curriculum is itself, I think, a bit of a red flag. Like, why is this your priority when there are much bigger fish to fry? And what does that suggest about the future governance of Syria? So all of these things are being watched very closely, and we'll have to see how they play out.
I'm sure it'll be great. I mean, don't you think it'll just be pushing governance novel ways into the 21st century? All right, let's talk about how is the U.S. government interacting with the new Syrian leadership?
So I've mentioned already that they've communicated concern over these some of these raids on Alawite communities, or some of the attacks that we've seen on Alawite communities. There's also been a bit of movement on the legal front. The Biden administration was kind enough to rescind the $10 million bounty that it had, the U.S. government had imposed on Ahmed Ashara back when he was again running al-Qaeda's Syrian franchise. The Treasury Department earlier this week issued a temporary general license to permit certain kinds of transactions with the Syrian government. Now, the Syrian government under Assad was proscribed under what was known as the Caesar Act. Sanctions that basically, made it impossible for any company or individual who wanted to continue to, say, do business with the United States to do business with Syria. They haven't lifted any of those sanctions. And this is the point of issuing this temporary license, is they don't have to lift the sanctions. They're still technically in place. But this is a promissory note, I guess, effectively from the U.S. government that we won't punish you. We won't punish companies, individuals, if they engage in certain types of permitted transactions, which have to do mostly with humanitarian work. The U.S. government issues these kinds of exemptions all the time with respect to sanctions, and they rarely work as intended because the institutions that would be involved in these kinds of transactions are still too afraid of kind of overstepping their bounds and facing legal retribution, so they just don't involve themselves at all. Why would you, risk punishment from the U.S. just to do business in Syria? It doesn't make financial sense. So we'll have to see if it actually works in this case. I'm not terribly optimistic. However, there has been one bit of movement under this already. The Qatari government is stepping in to basically pay Syrian government salaries for at least a little while. I don't know how long they're planning to do that, which should inject some money into the country, which should, kind of maybe help stabilize things a little bit, give a little bit of a boost in the economy. But we'll again, these are all kind of wait and see type things. Still a very fluid situation.
So has Trump said anything or no?
I haven't seen any comment from Trump about Syria. We can talk about some of the things that Donald Trump has said later on. They're really wild stuff. But I have not seen him say anything about Syria. I haven't seen even anything much out of his transition team, which has been involved, for example, in the Gaza ceasefire negotiations. We can talk a bit about those as well. But I haven't seen, and that doesn't mean it's not happening or hasn't been said and I just missed it, but I have not seen any Trump commentary or involvement vis-a-vis Syria as yet.
Yeah, I wonder if he'll even do anything. Let's talk about the continued fighting between Turkey and the Syrian Democratic Forces.
This is the biggest of the several issues that could be facing this new interim government. There's also some trouble brewing in southern Syria, I think. But the main issue is that there's still fighting going on, despite a U.S.-brokered ceasefire that's supposed to be in place around the town of Manbij. There is still fighting between the so-called Syrian National Army, the Turkish-backed militant group or militant network, and the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the predominantly or Kurdish-led and Kurdish kind of Arab as well faction that is backed by the United States. There have been scores of fighters killed on both sides in recent days. I think the latest was there's a report of 37 fighters killed in a new clash outside Manbij just over the last few hours or the last day or so. So the fighting is still clearly going on. The Turkish government's position here is that it's demanding that the SDF, or more specifically the YPG, which is the Kurdish militia that controls the Syrian Democratic Forces, is at the top of the hierarchy, that it effectively disarm, that its foreign elements, which basically means Kurdish fighters who have come to Syria from Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, leave Syria, and that the group itself disarms and submits itself to the new authorities in Damascus, which there's been discussions, and Shara has talked about this, about incorporating the YPG into a state security apparatus, formal security apparatus, which would probably satisfy the Turks' concerns to some degree, but that would require a negotiation process. It's going to require, ironing out the details about how the SDF would be incorporated. Would it be incorporated as its own unit, or would it be dissolved and its fighters brought in as parts of other, parts of other units? All these kinds of details that would have to be worked out, and it's very difficult to imagine that the YPG would be willing to have these negotiations with a Turkish gun, pressed at its back. So the conflict itself kind of precludes, I think, serious talks from happening. Now, Ankara has suggested that it's willing to wait or willing to give these negotiations a chance, but the continued fighting really indicates that may not be the case. And caught somewhat in the middle of this, again, is the U.S., which is, of course, allies with Turkey through NATO, but also the patron, basically, of the Syrian Democratic Forces. And there's questions about how far it might go or be willing to go defend the Syrian Democratic Forces from Turkey. Probably not that far, given the U.S. History of abandoning the Kurds when they become inconvenient. But again, it's a bit unknown. And certainly with Donald Trump coming back to office, we know from his first term that he was not terribly keen on being in Syria in the first place. So he may try again to withdraw and kind of give Turkey free rein to do what it wants, but we'll have to wait and see.
Let's move on to Lebanon, and let's talk about what the IDF is doing as it faces its withdrawal deadline.
The ceasefire that the IDF, the Israelis negotiated with Hezbollah in November, had a 60-day deadline for the Israeli military to withdraw from southern Lebanon. That's probably not going to happen. Shocker of shocks, I know. But the ostensible concern that the Israelis have is that the Lebanese military, which is, to be fair, a pretty hollowed-out institution, is not meeting its obligation to move into southern Lebanon and displace Hezbollah and kind of make sure that Hezbollah stays north of the Latani River, as the agreement specifies, and away from the border. And so the IDF isn't going to withdraw completely until that happens. The U.S. government is trying to take some steps here. I think there was a report in Reuters this week that the Biden administration is going to divert around $95 million in military aid that was supposed to go to Egypt, that has been called into question, especially in Congress, due to human rights concerns regarding the Egyptian government. They're going to divert that to Lebanon instead, which could support the Lebanese military in its operations as it tries to fulfill its end of the bargain. Amos Hochstein, the U.S. envoy in this situation, has been insisting that the IDF will withdraw from southern Lebanon completely. He has not said they'll do it by the time, by the deadline that was laid out in the ceasefire agreement. But they're still basically pushing this idea that it's going to happen. Yeah, that's sort of where things stand. Now we can talk about the presidential election, which may have some implications for what the Lebanese military is able to do moving forward.
So as you just said, the Lebanese parliament has finally elected a president. So what's going on there?
On Thursday, the parliament, after over two years since the end of Michel Aoun's presidency in October 2022, finally elected a new president, the commander of the Lebanese army, Joseph Aoun, no relation to Michel, apparently. And this really came together fairly quickly. Parliament has tried numerous times over the last couple of years to elect a president and has been too fragmented for anyone to get enough support to win. Aoun emerged as the consensus candidate just earlier this week, particularly after the other prominent candidate, Suleiman Frangieh, who's the grandson of the former Lebanese president by the same name, announced that he was withdrawing from the contest. He had been the preferred candidate of Hezbollah and its parliamentary faction or its parliamentary allies. Aoun had support among parts of the kind of Hezbollah opposed factions in parliament. And once Frangieh was out, and Hezbollah has for a couple of weeks now, and its allied parties, but particularly Hezbollah, has been kind of indicating somewhat obliquely that it wouldn't really have a problem with Aoun, and it could probably get behind him as president. And, you know, the theory, you know, I think, which is correct, this has a lot to do with the fact that they've, you know, taken it on the teeth somewhat in this recent war with the Israelis. And so they're, you know, kind of, I guess, you know, trying to recover from that and maybe take a less politically, they're a little weakened, I think, by all of that. So, you know, they're willing to accept. They have indicated that they're willing to accept Aoun as a compromise candidate, and he was elected on Thursday. So, there was some concern about his candidacy in that Lebanese law does not permit active duty military or currently serving government officials from running for president. Does not allow that to happen. And so in order to win, Aoun couldn't just win by a simple majority, which is possible, you know, if the voting goes to a second or third ballot. There's a first ballot requirement of two-thirds majority. But if it goes past that, then you know, you can win by simple majority. But Aoun could not do that. That avenue was not open to him because essentially electing him requires amending the Lebanese constitution to allow allow him as an active duty military officer to become president. So there was some concern whether he would be able to meet that threshold. And he did on the second ballot win with, I think, 99 votes out of 128. So clearly well over the two-thirds threshold. You know, this opens up a lot of things. The Lebanese government has been paralyzed since Michel Aoun's term ended. The president is supposed to nominate the prime minister. The prime minister is the more powerful of the two executive positions in the Lebanese system, but it's impossible to name one without a president in place. So the country's been under a, you know, threadbare kind of caretaker government for over 2 years now. This allows the appointment of a real government, potentially, if parliament can get its act together to do that, as well as potentially strengthening the Lebanese military, given Aoun's connection to that institution. Possibly, you know, if there is a president who can kind of rally things and get the military in place to monitor a ceasefire in the south, it would be this guy. So that's the hope anyway.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about the Gaza ceasefire talks, to reuse that word, that have been going on.
There's not a whole lot to say here, and that may actually be a good thing. But they did resume over the weekend in Qatar. The Israeli government sent a delegation to Doha to participate. There's been some up and down reporting about this, kind of optimism mixed with pessimism, I guess. The latest bit of pessimism, that major one that I saw, was from the Wall Street Journal, which reported late last month in December that the talks had hit another impasse, basically over the same thing that's been confounding them all along, which is that Israel is objecting to several aspects of what Hamas is demanding, including its demand for an eventual permanent ceasefire and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, or military withdrawal from Gaza. It also objects to some of the names on the list of Palestinian detainees whom Hamas wants to see freed as part of the captive exchange part of the deal. It doesn't seem like there's been any real progress made on bridging those gaps, which, as I say, have been gaps for months now and have been insurmountable, presumably. That said, there does, as I say, seem to be this undercurrent that we can finally get a deal done. The arrival of Trump's presidency or his inauguration may be putting some impetus under this. Trump has threatened that there will be hell to pay if the hostages aren't released by the time he's inaugurated, which, you know, is supposed to, I guess, frighten Hamas into doing a deal. Who knows what the internal discussions are there about Donald Trump. There are also concerns about the identities of the hostages. Now, Hamas has provided a list. This is a bit of progress. It's provided a list of 34 October 7th hostages that it would be releasing in the first phase of a deal, but it cannot guarantee that all 34 are still alive, and that may be a sticking point as well for the Israelis. Now, all that said, there was a piece I saw in Haaretz quoting an Israeli source on Wednesday who noted the fact that there isn't much more to say, or the reason that there isn't much more to say beyond these kind of basic parameters or the basic information about what's still to be negotiated is because everybody seems to be keeping things close to the chest this time around, more so than in past instances where we've been supposedly close to a deal, which could indicate a level of seriousness on the part of the Israelis and Hamas, the mediators, that may be a positive thing. But, you know, it's hard to know for sure.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So things are heating up on the Azerbaijan-Russian front in terms of this downing of an aircraft. So explain to us what happened, Derek.
On December 25th, Christmas Day for many of us, not for you. That's true.
That's pretty offensive. I'm going to go to HR, and I'm also HR.
I was thinking more of the folks in the region who tend to celebrate on the Orthodox calendar.
Course,
but
of course,
yes. So on December 25th, an Azerbaijan Airlines commercial flight crash landed in Kazakhstan, well off course, apparently after having been shot down by Russian air defenses. Now, this comes obviously in the context of the invasion of Ukraine and the conflict that spawned. But the Azerbaijani government has been increasingly, I think, frustrated with the response it's been getting from Russian officials. Vladimir Putin publicly apologized for the crash because it took place in Russian airspace, but he has refused, and nobody else in his administration will do this, obviously. He's refused to acknowledge what the Azerbaijani government seems clearly to believe, or maybe even can prove at this point, was the involvement of the Russian military in downing this aircraft. So there's no willingness on the part of Moscow to accept real culpability for what happened. And of course, that would lead to discussions potentially about compensating the victims and their families. So, you know, all of this is to say that Azerbaijani officials seem pretty frustrated by this, including Ilham Aliyev, who has hitherto had a very good relationship with Putin, and Azerbaijan has had a good relationship with Moscow or Russia in general. But this seems to be a real sore spot. And it may be, I've seen this speculated, that Aliyev is availing himself of the opportunity posed by this incident to sort of demonstrate some Azerbaijani independence of Russia, or, you know, that Azerbaijan doesn't really need Russia and it's okay. He's allowed to get mad at Vladimir Putin and not get in trouble for it because Azerbaijan is, you know, so wealthy and strong. He may be doing a bit of that, kind of, you know, puffing out his chest. But I do think there is some serious potential diplomatic ramifications of this. The relationship between Russia and Azerbaijan plays into the regional dynamic between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which is a treaty ally of Russia, but it's nevertheless kind of been sold out by the Russians in their conflict with Azerbaijan, because the Russians don't want to, wreck their relationship with Baku, which may be happening now anyway. So we'll see if there's any deeper reverberations of this, but it is something I think to keep an eye on.
Well, things are also going a bit south in Southwest Asia as Afghanistan and Pakistan exchange cross-border fire. Derek, illuminate us.
The relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan since the Taliban took over in Afghanistan has not been great. The expectation, I think, on the Pakistani side, since they have historically had a good relationship, their military and intelligence establishment had a good relationship with the Afghan Taliban, was that this would be, you know, things would go swimmingly. Afghanistan would, you know, become somewhat of a client state for Pakistan. But instead, the Afghan Taliban has kind of continued to host the Pakistani Taliban in particular and its fighters, as that group, you know, kind of bases or some of its factions at least base themselves in Afghanistan and carry out attacks in Pakistan, which has led to a lot of tension building up and building up in that relationship. On December 24th, the Pakistani military conducted airstrikes against presumably Pakistani Taliban positions in Afghanistan's Paktika province and killed at least 46 people, a major escalation in this kind of back and forth that the two countries have been having. The Afghan military retaliated a few days later by lobbing artillery, shelling across the border. I haven't seen any indications of casualties from that retaliation. Nevertheless, this is, as I say, a pretty major escalation in this long-standing beef that Islamabad and Kabul have had. And I think, you know, entering 2025, if you're trying to look for places where there could be much more serious conflict in the new year, this is one thing to pay attention to, how this situation plays out.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about South Korea, which is still trying to arrest it's Prime Minister Yoon there, right? Or is it President?
President.
It's Yoon. President. It's President, yeah. Yoon.
There is a Prime Minister involved in this story.
Yes. Apologies. I had looked this up before. And in other good news, the interim president has also been impeached. So
also the Prime Minister. So basically, last month, the South Korean parliament, which had already impeached Yoon Suk-yeol, decided to also impeach his replacement, the Prime Minister Han Duk-soo, which has left the South Korean government kind of scrambling at this point. The finance minister, Choi Sang-mok, is now acting prime minister and acting president. There's a certain level of dysfunctionality that I think has to come along with that. But yes, as you said, there is an ongoing effort to arrest Yoon. The South Korean Corruption Investigation Office obtained a warrant earlier this month, I believe, for Yoon's arrest related to his decision to try and self-coup effectively, you know, last year and his move to impose martial law. They've characterized that as an act of corruption or crime against the state. And so they are trying to arrest him. They got a 7-day warrant for his arrest from a court earlier this month and then attempted to enforce it late last week, only to be thwarted by presidential security forces. Yoon is holed up at a residence in the Hanamdong neighborhood of Seoul, and he's surrounded by his presidential security detail, and they would not allow police in to arrest him.
One of Yoon's lawyers said the suspended president could not accept the execution of the arrest warrant. They argued that it was issued by a court in the wrong jurisdiction and that the team of investigators formed to probe the incumbent leader had no mandate to do so.
The 7-day warrant then expired. They have now obtained another warrant. I don't know what the time frame is on that one, presumably longer than 7 days. And the effort to arrest Yoon is still continuing, though they have to deal with the same issue, which is his security detail is apparently not going to allow it. So, things are not great in Seoul right now, I think, from a stability standpoint, which given the potentially tumultuous changeover in power in the U.S. is not great timing from the South Korean perspective.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason he's so freaked out is that people in the past have been sentenced to death for treason, right?
I think you're right. I don't know the history of this stuff well enough to say, but yes, I mean, I think he's very concerned.
It's like actual real consequences
he could be, right,
for things about like
consequences.
This. Unlike in the United States.
Yeah,
where
right,
you just get
exactly.
elected again.
You just, right, you do a thing and then we say, oh, well, let's look
forward. What a country, backwards. Derek. What a country. Speaking of, this is a pretty
some
grim
places
one.
Still enforce the law, yes.
As I just said, this is a pretty grim one. The Biden administration has determined that the RSF has committed a genocide in Sudan. So, Derek, tell us.
The administration announced this on Tuesday that it has concluded that the Rapid Support Forces Group's activities in Darfur do constitute genocide. It cited the RSF and its militia kind of auxiliaries, the so-called Janjaweed militia. And that essentially is the same cadre of tribes, Arab tribes, that were responsible for most of the worst aspects of the 2003-2005 Darfur genocide. So basically repeating their attacks on non-Arab communities in the Darfur region, they're accused of not just massacring civilian populations, but of withholding humanitarian aid from communities that have been impacted by the RSF's conflict with the Sudanese military. And, that's rolled into this determination of genocide. The administration also unveiled new sanctions targeting the leader of the RSF, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, as well as a number of companies that are based in the UAE and are allegedly responsible for helping to arm the RSF. The UAE has been accused credibly of supplying weapons and especially drones to the RSF to enable it to battle the Sudanese military in return, essentially, for funneling gold out of Sudan into UAE markets. The UAE denies this. I'm not sure anybody even in the UAE believes that, but they do at least formally deny it. The determination comes after the U.S. government has already accused both the RSF and the Sudanese military of committing war crimes, but this is obviously another level beyond that, and specifically targeting the RSF.
Thanks, Derek. And as many people have noted, this is, of course, ironic given the United States' position vis-a-vis Israel.
I agree with that. I think it's I don't like talking about it because I think it distracts from Sudan to
what's
make
actually
it,
going on. Yeah,
from what's actually. I mean, it's the fact that the administration is wrong about Gaza doesn't mean it's not right about what's happening at Darfur. And I think the focus should be on that. But I do get those arguments.
Let's note the irony.
Yeah,
irony noted.
The irony and move on, right?
Let's talk about this new Ukrainian offensive in Kursk.
This is unfolded over the last few days. The Ukrainian military confirmed on Tuesday that it's undertaking what it called new offensive actions in Kursk Oblast in Russia. That came a couple of days after the Russian military had said it was seeing new Ukrainian activity or a new Ukrainian offensive. I don't know how much progress they're making. There are some indications apparently from, people who do like geolocating video or satellite analysis, that type of thing, that the Ukrainians have made a bit of territorial progress, but I don't think very much. And I suspect that the aim is not really to retake territory or to take new territory or anything like that, but rather to demonstrate to Donald Trump that the Ukrainian military still has some fight left in it. There are, of course, questions about what Trump intends to do when he takes office. He's been a skeptic of the conflict. He's also, though, and some of his transition team have indicated that he will continue to arm the Ukrainian military, support the Ukrainian military for some period of time while negotiations he's hoping to get underway with Russia to end the war. He's not going to just cut the Ukrainian military off, which would undermine the negotiating position. But how long he's planning to do that, I've seen references now that they're making to ending the war within 6 months. So the Ukrainians may be, able to rely on 6 months worth of support from the U.S. But I think basically they're trying to send a message to him that their cause is not lost and he shouldn't just kind of throw in the towel and give the Russians whatever they want.
Speaking of causes perhaps being lost, the Russians are advancing in eastern Ukraine.
I mean, as ever, this offensive in Kursk is not having any effect on the Russian military's operations in eastern Ukraine. And they took the town of Kurohovia, they announced on Monday, which is in Donetsk Oblast in eastern Ukraine, and has been a target of the Russian military for months now. They had essentially surrounded it and encircled it. Anyway, so, it was more or less cut off, and its value in the immediate term after months of intense conflict to pulverize the town is questionable, but it is another important bit of Donetsk that is now under Russian control, another part of the Donbass region, if you prefer, that is under Russian control, which has been presumably a war aim for the Russians to get that whole region under their control. It may also allow the Russians to shift additional forces, having captured one of their two main objectives. They can shift potentially some forces toward securing the capture of the other main objective, which is Pokrovsk to the north, a bit more strategically significant, I think, especially for the Ukrainians because of its status as a transportation hub and kind of important kind of keystone of the Ukrainian defensive line. The Russians may be able to increase the pressure on Pokrovsk, and they were only a few kilometers outside of that city last I saw. So that may be something that develops here pretty quickly.
Yeah, very interesting, of course, to see what Trump will do. Well, Derek, the country that gifted the world Adolf Hitler looks set to elect a far-right government. So what's going on in Austria?
Yeah, well, I mean, what could go wrong, really? It seems fine. Austria held a parliamentary election in September that was won technically by the far-right Freedom Party. The Freedom Party didn't win enough, came nowhere near winning enough of a percentage of the seats in parliament to have sole majority. So there was obviously going to be coalition talks that followed. And the second, third, and fourth place finishers in the election, led by the Conservative People's Party, decided to basically do the traditional cordon sanitaire around the Freedom Party and to negotiate their own coalition that excluded the far right. And those talks had been going on really since September, but they finally broke down when one of the smaller parties in the potential coalition walked away from the table a few days ago, which caused the chancellor of Austria, Karl Nehammer, who is also the leader of the People's Party, to step down in both capacities. And he was the main fire break, I guess, within the People's Party toward the regarding the idea of going and entering a coalition with the Freedom Party. So there is a sentiment within the People's Party that it would be okay to do a deal with the Freedom Party, where the People's Party serves as the junior partner in that coalition. Niehammer had been kind of the one holding up the stop sign on that. And now that he's resigned, he's been replaced by a new party leader who is more amenable to cutting a deal with the Freedom Party. Freedom Party and its leader, Herbert Kickl, I'm not even going to try to affect a German accent here, sorry. But
it's usually, if it's an I, it's Kickl. It's Kickl.
Kickl,
like
okay,
Ludwig
Kickl.
Von Mises, yeah.
So he's been tapped now by Alexander Van der Bellen, the president of Austria, to form a government. There's only one possibility there, which is for the Freedom Party to negotiate a deal with the People's Party on a two-way coalition. That's likely to happen at this point. If it fails, if those negotiations fail, I think Kickl sounds like he would be more than happy to go to an election, a snap election, because polling indicates that the Freedom Party's support has grown substantially over the last few months since September. And so they might be in line to, but they would certainly be in line to win again and might even increase their presence in the parliament if they were to hold a snap election at this time.
Well, Derek, Jake, put in some funeral music. One of the best friends of the pod, someone we've known and loved for years, is no longer in politics. That's right, everyone. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has resigned and will be becoming the third Mike of American prestige. So look forward to his hot takes on everything from fisheries to something else with an F that I can't think of because it's
really
dynamic early in the
guy,
morning.
Yeah. Really
tell us what happened with Trudeau, Derek.
I mean, it's not, there's not much to say here. The Canada has to hold a general election by late October, and the Liberal Party's polling is somewhere south of, I mean, they're polling in like the teens, I think, at this point under Trudeau. And Trudeau himself has approval ratings that are sub Joe Biden here in the U.S. So, you know, the writing was pretty much on the wall here. The polling has the Conservative Party 20 plus points generally. I mean, there have been some polls that are a bit under that, but generally 20 plus points ahead of Trudeau's Liberal Party. And in head-to-head polling, when you ask people, ask Canadians who their preference is to be prime minister, Trudeau trails way behind the leader of the Conservative Party, Pierre Poilievre, who doesn't seem to be a terribly charismatic guy, but nevertheless is not Justin Trudeau, and I think benefits greatly from that. And so it was clear that Trudeau is a drag on the party. If there's any chance that they have to salvage this election and at least not get blown out, I don't think there's much chance that the Liberal Party is going to win or pull out a surprise victory, although, you know, who knows, anything can happen, I guess. But if they're at least going to not get blown out, that Trudeau had to go, and he finally acceded to that. His resignation comes a couple of weeks after his deputy prime minister, Chrystia Freeland, resigned sort of in disgust over the way that Trudeau was responding to recent comments from Donald Trump, essentially threatening to annex Canada and make it the 51st state. I'm sorry to laugh. It's just so absurd. We are entering a really absurd time. But you know, that sort of started I think that kicked off a wave of discussions about Trudeau and whether he could really maintain himself as party leader through the election. And he finally acceded to it this week. Freeland emerges, I think, right away as the most prominent potential candidate to succeed him. The Liberal Party will hold an internal leadership contest that should be over within a couple of months, and whoever wins that contest will supplant Trudeau as prime minister until at least the election later this year.
Well, Derek, you kind of already gestured toward it, but incoming President Trump is returning to 19th century dreams to buy Greenland. So what has Trump done here?
He's made a lot of comments lately about places that he would like to become part of the United States. Basically, he's threatened to annex Canada. That was in the context of the kind of a public spat with Trudeau over the tariffs that Trump wants to impose on Canadian imports, and Trump basically demeaning Canada as effectively the 51st state anyway. Why don't we just bring it in, make it official? So, you know, there's that. But he's also talked about acquiring the Panama Canal, or at least, or maybe all of Panama. I'm not entirely sure what his thought process is there. And Greenland, to which he sent Donald Trump Jr. earlier this week, in what I can only assume was an attempt to pummel the Greenlanders into submission and, you know, get them to the point where they'll beg to be taken over by the U.S. If you just have this guy leave, we don't want him here anymore. But he's talked about acquiring both of those places. He's also talked about renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America for some reason.
Honestly, that's like old Trump, you know, like just something really annoy all the libs.
Purpose that would serve, I don't know.
It's ridiculous. You know, so how would he even do it? Does he even know, like, go to the
I mean, he would just change the maps. I mean, this is the thing that happens in the Persian Gulf. The Arab countries, you know, refer to it as the Arabian Gulf.
Right, right, of course.
Nobody else has to respect that, and nobody does. You can, but you don't have to, and that would be the case here, presumably. Claudia Sheinbaum, the president of Mexico, kind of retorted here that her government might start referring to basically all the territory that the U.S. acquired in the Mexican-American War as America Mexicana or something.
Yeah, something Mexicana, like that. Yeah, Mexico,
something
America,
like that. Yeah. So, yeah.
¿Por qué no le llamamos América Mexicana? Se oye bonito, ¿no?
That would probably annoy him quite a bit if she did that. So who knows? Good luck to her.
Well,
You know, it's all fine to laugh about this stuff, and it's silly, and none of it's going to really happen. But it's a little bit troubling, I think, that when he was asked at a press conference earlier this week in Florida whether he would rule out the use of military force to take Greenland and Panama, he refused to do that. So that's not great. And it's one of those things where you can say, you know, Donald Trump says a lot of crap and nothing ever really comes of it. But when the U.S. president says things like we might invade Greenland, who knows? That has reverberations, that has repercussions. The Danish government is, clearly not thrilled with this, and a number of other NATO members have kind of chimed in to express a little concern about the rhetoric that he's using. It's one of those things where if you're the ex-president, or if you're just some former, you know, kind of washed up game show host who talks about politics sometimes, and you tweet something like this, everybody can sort of roll their eyes and laugh. But when you're the president-elect or the president of the United States and you say things like this, they have import, even if you are yourself an idiot who has no way of enacting any of this stuff. It still has repercussions. And I think we're back to those days. I mean, we experienced it the first time around, but we're going to experience it again, and probably in an even zanier way this time around. So strap in, buckle in, whatever.
I was just going to say, everybody strap in. Let's do it. Well, thank you, Derek. And again, Happy New Year to everyone. We've got a bunch of specials coming out. Everyone check those out. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.